Well, thank you very much, and it's my pleasure to be here. And I'll ask you to please mute your microphone while I'm speaking because I'm hearing echo back from the room. Thanks. And I'll let you type to me whether you need a higher or lower volume on the speaker. It sounded pretty good coming in there, so I think we're probably okay. Thank you for welcoming me back to New Zealand, even if it is virtually. I have still very fond memories of my time in the country and do hope to come back one day. And it's certainly a pleasure to be able to speak to you all again this time at eFest. I still remember the talk that I gave at eFest on groups and networks. And it's interesting that we're doing this talk today because this talk is very much a follow-up from that sort of thing, taking many of the ideas that I expressed more theoretically then and talking about them more applied. Although I will say this, I was a bit concerned to discover that I was coming after not only George Siemens, but also after Dave Cormier and Jeff Lebo. By the time you guys got to me, there'd be nothing left to say. And so they probably said everything that I want to say, but I'll say a few things anyways. I'm going to keep this actually very straightforward. I'm going to describe how we've set up our massive open online course. I'm going to talk a bit about what we did and what we were trying to do, what the students did, how they took off with the concept, and then wrap up briefly with the design principles that we intended to follow. Most of this talk I would like to leave to questions, although I say that and then I go for 60 minutes. I do intend to try to leave time for questions so that we can actually talk about the design of the course as it relates to the principles of connectivism that George talked about. I wonder what Dave talked about. I think it would have been interesting. I'm going to have to go back and try to get the audio of his presentation. I was, of course, sitting up here, so I wasn't able to listen to Dave and Jeff, which is too bad. Anyhow, so I'm going to close the video part, and then they asked me to make it nice and big. So okay. Present. And so in massive widescreen glory, here are my slides. This first one's kind of a boring slide because it's just the title. So MOOC and Mookies. Mookies is my own word, thank you very much, and I've decided to call people who are participating in a MOOC Mookies. Why? Because, well, what else would you call them? Anyhow, here's the story to date, and you may have heard this earlier, but George Siemens and I are teaching a course called Connectivism and Connective Knowledge. Right now, we have roughly 1,900 students signed up. That's how many people I've got in my system, certainly. And they're going through a 12-week online course. And so far, it's like they're trying to do the 12 weeks in the one first day. And mostly we're telling them, slow down, it's a 12-week course, but still. Some of these students, about 22 or 23 of them, the limit was 20, and George admitted some extras, are paying tuition to the University of Manitoba, but most of the people, and I'm very pleased about this, are attending this as an open course. The course itself, as I say, offered through the University of Manitoba, 12 weeks long. It's a credit course and certificate of adult and continuing education and certificate in emerging technologies for learning. And actually, that brings me back. It takes me back. The very first online course that I built was for the certificate in adult education in Manitoba. And this was back in 95, 96. We launched it. It was the first online course in Manitoba. It was a demonstration course for Assiniboine Community College. That certificate in adult education became, over time, the certificate in adult and continuing education. So it's part of the very same program that I did back in 95, 96. And I did that with Conrad Albertson and Shirley Chapman. And it was funny just thinking, we launched our course just on Monday, and the feeling that I had as we launched this course was remarkably similar to the feeling that I had when we launched the Certificate in Adult Education course. Although there, that course we did with a bit more of a flourish. We actually had a press conference, we had a reception, we had the press in town, we had distinguished visitors from Brandon, Manitoba, where we were launching the course, we had a big screen, we had a video of a rocket taking off to launch the course, and about 2 minutes before we were to show this, somebody tripped over the wire of the computer and unplugged the entire works. So we launched about 10 minutes late. Anyhow, you didn't need to hear that, but it's a good story. Right, moving on. So yeah, there's no, I don't see you. Even I gave another talk online this morning, I was able to see the crowd. Now I don't see you, so I can't tell whether you're staying in the room or getting up and leaving. But okay, well, somebody gave me a smiley face. Thank you, Allison. Okay, the course is on connectivism. George has talked to you about connectivism. My ideas are very similar to George's. They don't line up exactly perfectly, and we're hoping, as part of the process of this course, to be able to identify some of those places where they differ. I noticed even today George released a document that has that compares connectivism to other learning theories, and one of the points of comparison is in knowledge transmission. And this is a point where George and I will have to discuss, because I don't think that connectivism is a transmission-based theory. What that means is something that we'll have to talk about and work out at length over the course. But anyhow, connectivism, as you can see from the slide, at its heart, connectivism is the thesis that knowledge is distributed across a network of connections, and therefore that learning consists in the ability to construct and traverse those networks. What that means, then, is that the way we built the course is as a network of connections. And the learning in our course is designed to be constructing and traversing that kind of network. And I see they're all still here, says moderator. Thank you very much. I'm glad to hear that. Actually, the talk I gave this morning, I did see somebody get up and leave and say, oh, can't keep them in the room. Never mind. It's been a long day. So, okay. We think, and we did this deliberately, that our course is probably the best example of the theory that we're talking about. It's 12 weeks worth of readings and activities, of course. But what we want to do is to make the course itself the example of the theory that we're doing. So we sat down. We communicated by distance. We had some Skype conferences. Talked about the course itself, what we wanted to cover. George put some ideas on a wiki. Those ideas were transformed over time by various contributors into the 12 weeks. He put his things in there. I put my changes in there. People were able to see this well ahead of time, make their suggestions. Then we added the set of communications tools that I'm about to describe. And then, most interestingly to me, the students took over, and they really took it over. So, here's the wiki. This is the wiki that we began with. Just an ordinary looking wiki. You can see, I get a little thingy here. Okay. Can you see that? No, you must be able to see that. It's the little red light pointer. So you can see the different sections of the course and just general wiki type stuff. So that's how we began. That's where we began, was with the creation of this wiki. And following with that, and in the wiki, we opened the course up. And so we had a mechanism whereby people would enter their email address, and those email addresses all went to George. And George basically added them to a spreadsheet as they came in, not realizing that there would be ultimately 1,900 of them. So the course includes, as core content, if you will, the selection of readings. You know, I go back to the time when we launched that original CAE course in Manitoba, and the years that followed that, we talked a lot about learning objects and reusing learning resources, and there was all of this stuff about metadata and SCORM wrappers and all of that. Here we are reusing content, and what are we doing? We're linking to web pages. We're linking to PDF documents. That is reuse. And all of our content is basically reused learning content. It's the articles, the criticisms, the papers, things that are relevant to the topic of connectivism, including the talk that I gave at eFest 2 years ago. So after the wiki comes the blog. It's just your standard WordPress blog. George and I both post things on there. And again, prior to the course starting up, we posted what we expected the course to be like, how we expected to conduct ourselves. We had issues to address, for example, how are we going to treat the enrolled students who have paid tuition as compared to the open students who haven't paid anything. And the approach that we have taken ultimately is that the course will be exactly the same for the enrolled and the non-enrolled. The non-enrolled can, if they wish, do the assignments. Now, we have a commitment to actually evaluate the assignments for the enrolled students, but that's the only difference between them. There's a lot of talk and staring into the camera. I don't know why. And really staring into it as though it's on. There's a lot of talk about, how students should be able to do their work in a private space, in a safe space. My own attitude, and I express this in the blog, is that there's nothing wrong with students doing their work in the open, in a public place, and that in many cases this actually elicits better work on the part of the students. And there are plenty of examples of students doing their work in a public place. Musical performers, for example, actors, drama students, athletes, and so on. So I think there's nothing wrong with actually, if you will, performing in a public space. But anyhow, that's how we've chosen, and we'll see how that works. It will be a constant process of negotiating with the students who have paid, because I guess they're always paid, so they negotiate. Moving on, we also added as a fundamental component to the course a Moodle forum. Moodle is a fully fledged learning management system, but we're only using the forum part of this. We're not using the Moodle course presentation part of this. Moodle works okay as a forum. I have no real problems with it, and people have taken to it. It's familiar technology for them. There's a lot of people. We're into day three, and we've already hit Moodle comment overload. I think that'll ease off because it is a 12-week course, and so it is a pretty long slog for everybody. But I think Moodle will work fine as a threaded discussion list. Now, one of the things that we have to tell people, though, because we've already had people say, I can't handle this Moodle thing. And we need to say to them, well, then don't use Moodle. Part of the purpose of designing the course this way is that we're not requiring people to use any particular technology. If you're comfortable in a threaded forum, use Moodle. But if you're not comfortable in Moodle, or you think there's too much messages, or you just don't like Martin WMS, then don't use Moodle. It's your choice. A lot of people did use Moodle, and the first thing that they did, as you can see here, and these began well before the beginning of the course, as they began introducing each other. So we've got 4 pages of introductions, and now, I forget how many messages there are, there's hundreds of messages in Moodle now for the course. George also set up a PageFlix site. This PageFlix site is basically to aggregate material from across the web. What we've done is we've established a common tag, CCK08, and we've said to people, whatever you do, if you do a blog post, if you do a Flickr post, delicious comments, whatever, use the tag CCK08. Now, what this PageFlix does is it aggregates from various sources instances of the CCK08 tag. For example, you can see here's the TechnoRaddy aggregation. Here's aggregation from my own website, and I can't read that. And here's the weather in Manitoba. I don't know why that's there, but it's there. Another component we have is every Wednesday We're going to have Illuminate discussions. I say we're going to have because it's only Tuesday, and so the first discussion will be tomorrow. This is, of course, the technology we're using right here, so we're pretty sure it's going to work. We're not so sure it's going to work with 1,900 people. Just kidding. but we do have a license that allows us several hundred people, and George says we can probably get more seats in the license from Illuminate if we require it. The people at Illuminate are not surprisingly watching this course fairly closely because we're putting their system to the test. Interesting note on the Illuminate discussions. The Illuminate discussions, of course, are live discussions. They're synchronous discussions. Our course, as you'll see in a moment, is a global course, and so that raises the question, when do you put them on? Well, George, being in Manitoba, said, well, Wednesday evening, of course. Except Wednesday evening in Manitoba is the middle of night everywhere else in the world, well, except for Australia and New Zealand. And so we talked about that for a bit, and Dave Cormier, who has a lot of experience with these things, says, noon Eastern. Noon Eastern is the time that works best for the most people. Of course, that's 2 in the morning for the Australians, and they're usually a minority, so it doesn't matter. I'm just kidding. So I got a note just before this session started that now we're looking at 2 sessions on Wednesday, so I'm not sure how that will go, but we definitely have one for noon Eastern on Wednesday, and it looks like one for Wednesday evening tomorrow. I'm not sure if the split sessions will work, but that's how we're going to do it to start with. It is a bit tricky offering a course with synchronous sessions to a worldwide audience. The moderator jokes that everybody's left. Gee, thanks. Give me a little heart attack there. Just kidding. Another thing we're using is Ustream. Doing this in a couple of ways. You can see with a big arrow over my face here. I've used Ustream already to do an introductory video. Each Monday, as each week proceeds through the course, George and I are introducing some content over and above the readings. We're introducing this content in different ways in different weeks. George this week used a document that he authored, I believe, on Google Documents. I submitted a video which I created using Ustream. Turned out not such a good technology for me. It turned out to be a bit jittery, and I'm learning that the viewers are also seeing it as jittery, so I think the setup I had wasn't working perfectly. Nonetheless, I was able to create and distribute the video using Ustream. We will also be using Ustream to do a conference-style session. We're working together with Dave Cormier, Jeff Lebo, the EdTech Talk people, and what we're going to do is George and I will be signing on with Skype. We'll have Skype video, and Dave will be moderating that and sending that through a feed through Ustream and then out to the world through Ustream. So this should be a very interesting experiment. We're going to begin with audio. We're not going to begin with video. We're going to send audio streams through Ustream. And then I'm hoping that later on in the course, if everything's working pretty well, we can try this with video. The two live sessions are intended to do different things. The Wednesday session is intended to bring in a guest. We're going to bring Alec Koros from Saskatchewan in tomorrow, for example, and we'll be bringing in other guests through the course of the 12 weeks. And then the Friday session is a session where we're going to talk about what the students had to say, what comments they made, what the arguments were. Perhaps we'll bring on some students and have them explain their own positions as well. It'll be a recap of the week. So, can't have a course without Twitter, and so we have a CCK08 Twitter account, which I've used once because I'm not really a Twitter person, but the Twitter account actually is being used and is being read by a large number of people, and it was actually over the Twitter account that I learned today that we're doing a second session tomorrow. I still haven't gotten the email from George, but I saw the Twitter that he sent to the students, so there you go. Another major component is a piece of software that I've authored, and I'm very proud of, called Grasshopper. And what Grasshopper is a piece of software. It's the software that I use to produce my newsletter. So for this course, we're producing a daily newsletter. It comes out every weekday morning. We've produced two of them so far. There'll be another one coming out tomorrow morning. We're doing this because the course is very scattered. You've already seen a number of components. You've seen the Moodle, you've seen the page place, the wiki, the talks and all of that. You know, having a daily newsletter is kind of like having a lifeline hanging out there for people. If they get lost, if they're not sure what's happening, I'm waving my arms, you can't see that, but I am, then all they have to do is follow the daily. The daily will bring them back on track, and it'll point them to things that they can read. Now, the daily so far has just simply had highlighted resources, and you don't see it today because we didn't have one, but it also has announcements. Later on, we're also going to aggregate the feeds that are produced by people. What we've asked people to do is to sign in to the daily and to submit the address of the RSS feed for their blog, their wiki, their discussion area, whatever it is that they're using. We've asked people to use whatever tool that they want and to simply provide us with the RSS feed. In the back end of my software, and this is the administration screen for the Grasshopper software, we've imported all of the student addresses and set up accounts for every student in the course. And so what they have been doing is, here you can see, they've submitted the addresses of their RSS feeds. So we will be harvesting, using RSS, the feeds produced by all of the students. And in this way, it doesn't matter where students are producing their responses, their content. It can be anywhere on the web. We will gather it together. We will bring it together with this harvester and then present it in the daily. So people can look at their daily and in one place see all the different comments that were made all over the web by the different students. Now, if they don't want to use the daily, they don't have to. We're also providing an OPML file. And what this file here is, it's an XML file that you can use to create a list of RSS feeds to subscribe for yourself in an aggregator like Google Reader or Bloglines. So you can choose how you are reading other students' content. You can choose what students' content you want to read. And this is, again, an important point here. We've got 1,900 students here. We won't get 1,900 RSS feeds, I'm sure of that, because most people are lurkers, and that's fine. But we will get a large number of RSS feeds, which means that on any given day, there will be a large number of links created by people who posted comments about the course. And the idea here is that students should just simply pick and choose the content that appeals to them. It appeals to them by whoever wrote it, or it appeals to them by whatever the title and the short summary is. There is no expectation that they read everything. And indeed, we don't want people to read everything. It's too much content, first of all. And also, we get value from our interaction when people have read different things. Moving along, because I just got a note that says 10 minutes to go. 9:22. Oh my. This is a shorter session than I knew. Okay, never mind. It's a half-hour session. So, okay, course components, no problem. So here's the intro to the course. George did up a video where he introduces the course, describes the different elements of the course, and there's a little pop-up video within a video. I thought that was very clever, which features George's smiling face introducing the course to prospective students. And then the students took over. One of the things that they did is they created a course map. Now, these slides will be available on my website at downs.ca, and I do recommend that you have a look at this course map. You can see the URL for the course map here. This course map describes all the different technologies, and some that I haven't mentioned, like the Facebook group and so on. The class homepage, the Grasshopper stuff is up here, the daily, here's the page flakes, all the different elements and all the different linkages between the elements. And when you look at this course map, you actually see this web that we say a course should resemble. Here's the other course map, and here's what I mean by this being a pretty international course. This is a pretty international course. This is not all of the people in the course. This is simply those people in the course who have found the student website where a Google map has been created with people, where people will put their own pins into the Google map. And then another student created a video that describes how to put a pin into the map. Another student created Wordle diagrams of the course. Here's the first Wordle that was created early on in the process. Here's a second Wordle, and you can sort of see the changing emphasis as time goes by. And then finally, a third Wordle just as we're launching the course. And you notice we're much more semantically dense, and course, which was such a prominent word, has sort of gradually decreased in importance as compared to the other things. So this Wordle is still very process-oriented, which makes sense for a pre-course kind of thing. But I would like to think that as time went by, that the word course would get smaller and smaller and smaller and eventually disappear. And then, of course, there's the word of mouth. Students have been blogging about this course. George said he did a Google search and found 6,000 items listed for CCK08. Now, this is day two of the course. So the students, what else have they done? They've built Google Groups, or expensive Google Groups. They've offered translations. This is the translation into Portuguese. There's also a group out there called the Connectivitas, that are Spanish. And then there's the Venezuelan Connectivistas. There's the Colombian component. There's a Hungarian students and Hungarian translation and more. There's Dikita. I don't know what Dikita is. All I know is that CCK08 is in Dikita. I have no idea what it is. It's something I'm going to follow up after. And there's a Second Life cohort of something like 50 people where people are using Dijo and commenting. So apparently my introduction, What is Connectivism, has been annotated. People are using Delicious. People are using WordPress. And there's, if you look into WordPress blogs about CCK08, there's a whole list of blogs about CCK08. Anyhow, the principles. Now, these are my principles. I think they're mostly shared by George, but this is my articulation of the principles according to which this course has been designed. These principles should be familiar to those of you who were at my talk at eFest in 2006. And they were just being formulated then. In fact, I had actually articulated them clearly for the first time a couple of days earlier in Auckland, and I did that Groups versus Networks video, and then presented them on stage for the first time at eFest in Wellington. So the first principle is diversity. We want to encourage students to engage in diverse readings, to use diverse environments, to have diverse discussions. We don't see that there's any single content, any single core, any single set of things that everybody has to have in common. The strength here is in diversity. Second principle, autonomy. We don't want to tell students what to do. George and I will do our own thing. We'll do our own thing through the 12 weeks, and people can follow or they can not follow, and that's cool. But we want students to chart their own course, to select their own software, to pursue their own learning, to find their own readings. And what we're discovering is when students are able to do this, they find things we would never have found before. There's a book that was referenced in a blog post by Diego Leal today. I'd never heard of it. I forget the name of it offhand, otherwise I'd tell you. But the thing is, they find things, students find things that we would never know about, and they bring that into the discussion. And that doesn't happen unless they're free to make their own decisions. Third principle is interaction and connectedness. And now, this is not simply the idea that people should talk to each other, although it's partially that. But as the slide says, the knowledge in this course emerges as a result of the connections among the students and the staff. That is to say, the knowledge is something over and above what any of us says. It's not some content being shoveled, as I say here, from experts to recipients. You might think of it as the knowledge that is being produced in this course is the educational equivalent of the knowledge of how to fly the 747 from New York to Paris. No individual knows how to do that. No individual knows the knowledge that is being produced by this course. Rather, all of us together are producing some sort of body of knowledge that we can't comprehend as individuals, but which creates something that collectively advances the field forward. It's kind of a hard concept to get at, but I hope that helped. And then finally, principle of openness. We don't draw barriers between in and out, and that means that there isn't a hard line, engaged, not engaged. There isn't this idea that you're either with us or you're not with us. We can accommodate the fully engaged, we can accommodate the partially engaged, we can accommodate the lurkers. The idea here is that we have ties of different strengths. We have strong ties between the people who are very committed, and we have weak ties between the people who are just interested and might draw this connection that we might not otherwise see. So those are the four basic principles. Together I call them the semantic principle. And the reason I believe that these four principles are important is, according to the theory of connective knowledge, these four principles will create networks which are stable, will create networks which do not go into cascade phenomena, do not create mob psychology or group psychology, that will, over time, provide knowledge that is reliable, that can be trusted, that can be acted upon. This is my last slide, and so I'm pretty sure I've used up the 10 minutes that I had, and so that's my talk. And I'm going to turn off the microphone now. Thank you. And now I'm just waiting for their response. They're not hearing this. Okay, so I'm just waiting for questions now. Let's see if I can't put this...
Hey, G'day, Stephen. It's me, Michael, here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I hear you finally. You hear me? Oops. Sorry. Yes, I hear you finally. I just forgot to press the button.
Okay, great. I was just sitting here and thinking an idea with a guy sitting next to me who doesn't want me to say his name, but I'll let say it in Frank Simpson. We're thinking, you know, an idea where this model that you have could be so overwhelming for some people, a lot of people, where there could be agents around the place, such as what your students are doing already, setting up sort of sub-events, so that your event around the topic of connected knowledge and connected identity, you might have agents like, for example, myself. I would set up a sub-course focusing on a smaller number of people, and then I would take the role of managing the amounts of information that are coming through on the mega course, but helping to filter that through to a minor course. What would your reaction be to that sort of thing? I mean, given that it already goes on with students, what would your reaction be if, and I'm not saying this is going to happen in my mind, but if people started doing that, that proposes ideas for sectors like the Ministry of Education might, through economy of scale, employ some people like you on various topics to set up events like this that teachers in various subject areas can then attach to and be filtered and agents to. And one particular area I think that creates a problem, obviously, is your use of non-commercial licensing over the whole course.
Well, okay. First of all, questions already come up, believe it or not. We got an email from a person in Israel who wants to take the course from us, but who wants it accredited at his own local institution, or wants it looked at each other metaphorically, because we were two continents apart, scratched her head and said, sure, why not? And so basically the idea here is go ahead. So the only question, and now you raised the question of licenses, what is it of ours in particular that you're using, and how is it that you're using it commercially? See, we're not producing, if you will, content that is being reused or anything like that. We're producing, of course, the courses online. Anyone can go to the course. We're producing these Illuminate sessions or Ustream sessions or what. Your courses, your students, wherever they may happen to be, say they're somewhere like New Zealand, they can come look at our stuff. They can come look at come to our online session. They can take part in special events that you set up as well. There's no contradiction there. There isn't a reuse happening here in the classic sense of you taking our stuff and selling it, because you're not taking our stuff. Rather, you're sending your students to us. I don't even want to say it that way, because that's not even accurate either. Your students are sampling a lot of material, some of which is our material. Just like our students are sampling a lot of material, some of the material is CC by SA, others is CC by SA, non-commercial, doesn't matter. We don't care, because we're not reusing it. We're just sending them to wherever it's located to read it from the source. So I don't really see that there's a license issue at all there. It's only a license issue if you decide to take our course and package it and bundle it and then present it as some sort of object. But that's exactly what this course isn't. It's only if you try to do something with the course that the course isn't that you run into that sort of problem. I hope I didn't make that confusing.
Just maybe a comment on the idea that this might be a model fitting into existing education systems where, a Ministry for Education may commission some people like yourself, world experts in a particular topic, to run an event like this that then teachers can tap into, rather than the model of perhaps commissioning textbook publishers that get distributed to teachers and then their teachers teach from the text after that.
Yeah, I think that'd be pretty cool. It's my retirement plan, so I hope something like that works out. So far, this isn't retirement plan. I don't think I'm even being paid for this course. I'm pretty sure I'm not being paid for this course. I hope George is. Why not? George said earlier on that what we're doing with our course is we're doing the same thing to course delivery that MIT did for course content. We're showing that we can make course delivery open. And delivery, I use the word in a very wide sense, but that's what we're doing. This is an open delivery of a course. And so all that's remaining, really, is the assessment and the accreditation. And so if you think about this, we can offer our course, and we clearly have the technology to do it. We're doing it now. We can offer our course to a large number of people on a worldwide scale. We make the assignments public so everybody can see what the assignments are. Students do the assignments, submit them to their own local institution for assessment and evaluation. I have no problem with that, and I think that actually is a model something more like what the future of learning is going to be than the model we currently have.
Thank you, Steve. That was a good answer. Are there any other questions? Sean, Lee wants to ask you another one.
Sure.
I'm pretty sure I'm not jumping in if nobody else is putting up their hand. But Stephen, I wonder if you could give us references to what sort of things have inspired this model. Just you're aware of David Wiley's course, and Tamara Lennon's course, I mean, to what extent have their courses inspired or shaped some of the thinking behind yours? Just some references out to get a bit of context of what informs this model.
Yes, sure, no problem. David Wiley's course, of course, is an example. For those of you who aren't familiar with what David Wiley did, basically he set up a course on a wiki. He offered it at Utah State University, but he also opened up the course to allow anybody else to participate, and he led the class through a session of 13 or so weeks. So that was an influence, obviously. But also, too, like, that was more of a traditional course. It was much more constrained. It wasn't the distributed content. So we're also influenced by things like the development of the wiki, or not what I'm saying, the development of the personal learning environment, the concept of the personal learning environment. And so that's an influence. The whole network thing, I think, is an important influence, and obviously to George as well. I mean, the principle of connectivism itself, we might ask where that comes from. I can't speak so much for George, but for me, the original impetus to connectivism comes to a talk that was given by Francesco Varela at the University of Alberta back in, it would have to be about 1989-1990. Francesco Varela is a well-known philosopher, psychologist, who wrote and talked about networks, and was actually delivered at the University of Alberta Hospitals, and he was talking about immune systems. And what was interesting about what Varela said was not simply that he was talking about networks, but that he talked about successful and unsuccessful networks. And he talked about the idea of, you know, zero connectivity is not productive, but also 100% connectivity is not productive. And so you're searching for that middle point. And that's an idea that I've pursued with respect to networks ever since. And then finally, because I think this should be noted, the future of learning in a network world, the sessions that we had, Lee, in New Zealand, where we toured around the country for 2 weeks, fighting with each other. Well, maybe not fighting with each other, but it was a pretty grueling session. We saw, I think, every person in New Zealand at least once, going from city to city. That was the crucible where a lot of these ideas, certainly the principles of connectivism and connective knowledge, these were formed for me. I think that was an influence as well. And I'll stop it there.
Thank you very much, Stephen. I think we could just join me in thanking Stephen. And there's a lovely bottle of wine here for producers, and I'll look after that for you until the next time you've come.
Oh, I hope you all enjoy it now. Don't let that wine get any older. Whoops. Oh, yeah, I hope you all enjoy that now. Don't let that wine get any older. I always forget to press that microphone button. And to those of you listening online, thank you and goodbye.